You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS.
And Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, March 11, 2014. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Aaron Cameron, MSNBC.com, on California's quiet reproductive rights revolution. Maybe we'll touch on her recent report on the hardcore. They're so hardcore, they didn't even call themselves pro-life. Also on the program today, Senator Dianne Feinstein, chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee, makes some bombshell charges against the CIA, some of which we had talked about last week. In a short speech we have sound for you, we will play later in the in this half of the program. Tomorrow on the program, a reminder, we have Mark Mazzetti, who did the original reporting on the CIA spying on the Senate Intelligence Committee. Also on the program today, Chris Christie's BFF, David Sampson, subject of subpoenas from two different states' U.S. attorneys. The hammer is falling, the foot is dropping. All sorts of metaphors are happening to Chris Christie and those around him. What's that?
He has a full plate in front of him.
His full plate in front of him? No, that's not.
Legal issues.
People are taking away his plate. I don't know. There's all sorts of... He's so caught up in so many metaphors, folks. He's in big trouble. Last night, 30 Democratic senators pulled basically an all-night talk-a-thon to raise the awareness of the American public of the problems of climate change in this country. There's no particular legislation they're attempting to push. They probably realize that without greater public support, they're not going to be forcing the Republicans, preventing them from filibustering or whatnot. That said, they should also just look across Pennsylvania Avenue. Well, not really across. Down, I guess, and to the right or left, and tell President Obama not to permit Keystone XL. We will talk more about that in the program. And speaking of Obamacare, the latest fake story gets totally debunked. This one involving a middle-aged woman who has cancer and just refuses to believe that her new Obamacare insurance is cheaper than her old insurance, even though it is.
It's really turning into that old Monty Python thing in Life of Brian. Like, what have the Romans ever done for us? Remember that?
No.
Oh, God, Sam. All right. Moving on.
Moving on. And also, this is heartening news, or disheartening. Apparently, there are something like 210,000 ATMs in the country. and approximately 200,000 of them run on Windows XP. You'll recall Windows XP. It's that operating system which Microsoft will no longer be issuing updates for as of mid-April. Hilarity ensues. And speaking of which, Mike Huckabee at CPAC explaining how you run against a woman. You got to be chivalrous. All right, we got to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Aaron Cameron. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Erin Carmone. She is a reporter with MSNBC.com. Do I have that right?
Yep. That is all true.
Okay. I didn't want to improperly credit you or miscredit you. So, Erin, you've got two pieces that I want to discuss, and they're Tale of Two Cities? Not quite, but they're both ends of the spectrum in some respects. Let's start with the Abolish Human Abortion group, because we have seen the Republicans, particularly following 2012, but maybe this has been sort of a long-term agenda, to at least soften their rhetoric and their means in which to fight to rid women of this scourge of sovereignty over their own body. And there's some dissent within that, within those ranks. Tell us about the Abolish Human Abortion group.
You know, it's interesting. Not many people have heard of this group, but they have 34,000 likes on Facebook. And last week, 35 different chapters around the country showed up at high schools to preach their uncompromising view of how all abortion should be banned. So it's as much as the mainstream, what calls itself pro-life movement, has seemed to have enormous success in red and purple states around the country, these guys are not satisfied. There's this general feeling that, you know, that they should be going for everything all at once. What you're right that there has been an attempt to couch the desire to ban abortion entirely in every circumstance as a sort of women's health thing, as a regulatory issue. They've talked about fetal pain. They've basically come up with all of these rationales because both the country and the courts are not ready to ban abortion entirely, and they're hoping that this kind of incremental strategy will just chip away piece by piece until there's nothing left. That's exactly what you're seeing in Texas. So the reason that abolish human abortion is so interesting is because they're really grassroots and they're not involved in the political process. They say very honestly what they want, and they're intentionally provocative. They wear T-shirts that say "End child sacrifice." They're not pretending to be warm and fuzzy and concerned for quote unquote women's health. They are just saying what they want, which is, you know, they think there should, the anti-abortion movement should not make its peace with rape exceptions. They think even in cases of fetal anomaly, women should not have access to abortion. They think the morning after pill and daily hormonal birth control are tantamount to abortion. And these are not actually substantively so different from many of the mainstream organizations that get funding in D.C. or from the Catholic Church, but they're just, they don't have the political savvy or agenda to cloak it in more palatable terms.
Yeah, I would even say they have more, at least, intellectual honesty about it. I mean, I saw the report that you did for Melissa Harris Perry's program, and when you asked one of these activists, you know, what should happen to a woman who gets an abortion, and he more or less said, whatever happens to anybody else who murders a person. And
absolutely. I mean, there's an integrity to it. I personally disagree with them, but I think that there's a real consistency, and there's an appeal to that kind of consistency that, you know, many politicians don't have the luxury to or the courage, you might say, or the extremism to exercise.
Now, so I mean, how long have they been up to this? In other words, is this been a phenomenon that has been existing and just sort of on a parallel track and waiting for someone to come and report on it? Or is the trajectory of this group growing, and will it ultimately clash with the agenda of the more savvy, I guess, conservatives who essentially want the same thing? They avoid answering some of the questions. But is this going to clash at one point?
They are a relatively recent group. Most of them kind of formed, again, because it's so decentralized and they don't even have a 501c3. They are not formally organized. Around 2012 was when they came together. But I think that the reason that they're growing is in the same way that in progressive movements you see how people are able to find each other, able to organize without traditional mediated power structures. They have the same thing. And, you know, talking to them sometimes really feels like talking to a leftist, because they have a lot of disdain for the institutionalized politics of the pro-life movement, as they call it. They call themselves abolitionists. They think pro-life is weak sauce. So there's a very interesting dynamic where they're actually more interested in influencing their own movement and dragging it forward to this kind of, you know, just objectively very extreme position than they are, you know, in attacking Democrats. They're angrier at Mitt Romney than they are at Barack Obama.
Yeah, that was the question I had for you, is how much, I mean, who is it that they see is problematic, I guess, in terms of their agenda? And they see, and will they, I mean, ultimately, does this lead to them manifesting that feeling that they're more angry at the Mitt Romneys? Is this something that translates into electoral politics, or are they decentralized so much that they really aren't yet in a position to have any influence in that world?
They're less interested in electoral politics and more in influencing the people who have the ear of politicians. So I think, like any movement, it ends up getting influenced by the most passionate and engaged people. And these guys would consider success, if the mainstream pro-life movement, as they call it, would stop talking about how rape exceptions are okay. And they think that a 20-week ban is a sellout, whereas, you know, a pro-choice person might look at that and find it very radical. There's also this dynamic where they think that the pro-life movement is, like, making a lot of money off their cause, and they are the pure, fully engaged guys. They do this, the people profiled in my piece that aired on the Melissa Harris Perry Show on Saturday do this full-time and live off donations.
And lastly, is it for them? Is it a I mean, do they perceive this as a tactical? I mean, are they seeing this as something as different in terms of like their tactics, or do they perceive people who are less extreme in their presentation? Let's say, do they see them as making too many compromises, or as just fundamentally compromised in their perspective on abortion?
Right, they think they make too many compromises.
Okay.
But, you know, I should say also that this initiative where they're outside high schools, and they have been outside of, I would say by now they've probably been outside of at least 50 high schools around the country, they see everything as a potential conversion. I mean, that's why they spent time with me. They think they could, you know, last I spoke to them, they were still trying to convert me. So this is
ultimately a very... Do you want to give us an update on that?
I remain transparently and firmly pro-choice.
All right.
But there's an element of religious crusade to this in addition to the political aspect of it. And I think, you know, that didn't come out as much in our piece, but I think it's very much, they are very much the base of the anti-abortion movement, and they're really trying to influence the direction of it, which in turn influences electoral politics.
Interesting. You will, I guess, I trust, keep us updated on how that conversion is going. But I presume there probably won't be much updates, but who knows?
We shall see.
All right. Well, now, they must be very distressed to see the piece that you wrote, if they hadn't seen it already, about what's happening in California.
Right. Well, there's a lot that's happening in California that is incredibly revolutionary. For the first time ever, they passed a law regulating abortion that had to do with medical science, that was based in a multi-year peer-reviewed study showing that it is just as safe for nurse practitioners, for physician's assistants, and for nurse midwives to perform first trimester abortions. Just at the conclusion of the study and the law that they passed at the end of last year in California through the state legislature, they have added already almost 50 new abortion providers.
I think we should pause here for a moment and reflect on the idea that it's news that a state legislature would actually promote legislation based on research in this day and age. But let's talk about tell us about what that study was. It was a peer-reviewed study overseen by Tracy Weitz from the University of California. Tell us about what that study was and how it came about.
Well, there's this great operation at the University of California, San Francisco, out of the OBGYN department that is an interdisciplinary endeavor with sociologists, public health experts, and physicians trying to bring evidence-based research to the field of reproductive health, which, as we've just noted and is pretty evident in Texas, is a place in which, you know, evidence gets checked at the door and ideology becomes really the prevailing motive for everything, no matter what they, you know, say publicly. So they, in 2005, started a study that compared whether nurse practitioners, nurse midwives, and physician's assistants, if they performed early aspiration abortions, how safe that was compared to a physician. And what they found was that they were clinically identical in terms of risk. So as we know, physicians that provide abortions are targeted, they're stigmatized, there's violence, sometimes murder against them. So part of the what they were trying to do with the study is to place abortion within the spectrum and the continuum of primary care and make it something that was less extraordinary and less difficult to obtain, and ideally have a dynamic where a woman could see the same person, and particularly if she lived in a rural area, access abortion earlier in her pregnancy if that's what she wanted.
So the idea here is to simply make these services, these reproductive services, part of the services they get on a normal, regular basis from their healthcare providers. And my understanding is that part of this also has to do with it's the flip side of the of providing evidence about how restrictive abortion laws actually hurt access and actually also raise the number of late term abortions. Explain that dynamic.
Well, what San Francisco General Hospital, which is connected with the researchers in this study, what they were seeing is that women were often coming in later in pregnancy to have abortions than they wanted, that the later in pregnancy that you have an abortion, the more likely you are to have to pay more. There's a higher risk, even though it's overall still a very safe procedure. So I think when they were trying to figure out what is happening here, what they realized is that the women were having trouble coming from rural areas in California. Despite the fact that California is a very progressive state, it's also an enormous state, and there are people there who don't have the means for transportation. So a place like Eureka, California, where I reported out my story, is, you know, if you are past the cutoff point for an abortion there, which you can only get one particular day a week where the doctor comes to visit, you then have to drive 4 hours and pay even more money. And then the time that you're trying to raise the money to make that happen, it becomes even later and more difficult to get an abortion. And that's a very well-known phenomenon in people who work with women seeking abortion. So the idea is, you know, you can lessen the stigma, make it in a less traumatizing experience to kind of have to go through this fundraising process by making it easier for women to just go to somebody that they know and trust right by them. So it means probably fewer later abortions. It means less stress on the people who no longer want to be pregnant, and just an overall kind of normalization of a procedure that is, in fact, extremely common already.
I want to reiterate this this dilemma here, because in some ways it is fairly mundane in its practicality, but it has such huge bearing here, and I don't think that people fully appreciate this. I mean, it's also much harder, particularly, you know, if you live sort of in this corridor, the concept of having to drive or travel 4 or 5 hours for services that we take for granted, you know, living in at least, you know, in more urban areas. So in Eureka, a doctor comes once a week. That doctor is equipped or, I guess, licensed or simply chooses only to provide abortions up to 13 weeks and 6 days, nearly 14 weeks. If you miss that week and you're 12 weeks, pregnant, then that's it. Ball game over. And, you know, 12 weeks is not a lot of time to even be aware that you're pregnant, I guess, at that point.
Right. And you might discover something later in your pregnancy that means that you need to, you know, that you want to end your pregnancy. I think overall you're looking at enormous barriers, just geographical ones, in addition to economic ones, language. So I think that the goal of this was to say, you know, guess what? Women are having abortions for their own reasons, but they're encountering enormous barriers that have nothing to do with medicine. It's actually a very, very simple procedure. Another interesting thing that came out inadvertently from this study is that because they had such a huge sample size, they had 11,000 at the time of the American Journal of Public Health study, but by the end of the study, they had 20,000 wow. procedures to look at. And what they found is that abortion is even safer than they thought, had even fewer risks and complications in general than any other study had shown, because they had such a huge sample size they could really get a full picture of it. But for moral reasons, religious reasons, for moral judgments, there are still so many barriers to accessing this service. But women want it anyway. They're just being forced to suffer in other states that don't recognize that fact.
And so now, I mean, what are the when do we see the practical implications of this, you know, this study broaden out? I mean, they received a waiver to provide those for nurse practitioners, et cetera, to provide these services. Is this something that we're now starting to see throughout California?
Yes. So the study was operating on a waiver, but then using the results of the study, they were able to pass a law that was signed by Governor Jerry Brown in October. And the week that I was in Eureka was being implemented for the first time. Now the nurse practitioners and other advanced practice clinicians that were trained in that study, they can now work on their own without doctor supervision. And it's now legal for them, for other people, other advanced practice clinicians who are interested in providing these services to now be trained. This also had to go through the legislature. And that is something that is really interesting because there was a Democratic supermajority in California and there was a pro-choice governor. And the bill was sponsored by a powerful Democrat, Tony Atkins, who's now the speaker, at that point was the whip, who had formerly managed a bunch of abortion clinics and had really direct knowledge of this. So there were a lot of amazing and unusual circumstances that were aligning for this. But that said, you know, California is obviously an enormous state that is that this is going to impact a lot of women. And it also provides a model for other states if they're, you know, if the
right
terrain is right for this to say, guess what? The sky didn't fall. This may have really helped a lot of women access medical care and potentially fewer barriers for other states that may want to emulate this.
And so, I mean, in the course of your reporting, was there anybody there who said to you, we anticipate by X date that this many more women will have access to this medical procedure, to an abortion if they want one at the time that they want one? I mean, so in other words, the implications of this, I mean, does anybody have a projection as to what the implications are and when they'll be first be measured? And I assume, and maybe you know this, that somebody's also doing a study to see the implications of this broader rollout.
You know, I'm not aware of a specific follow-up study about this. That would be very interesting if that were going to happen. I'm not specifically knowledgeable about anything like that happening. But I think one of the things that they wanted to do was to make abortion less extraordinary. You know, I mean, I think it'll be the phrase safe, legal, and rare that came out in the 90s, most famously with Bill Clinton, I think in some ways is a misstatement of the ultimate goal here, because rare can also mean that there's a woman who wants to enter pregnancy and can't. You know, in Texas, abortion is now rare.
Well, I was going to say, this is the mirror image of Texas. When we hear of all of the arguments about, well, we need to make this more safe for women, therefore we're going to put extraordinary requirements on the healthcare providers, that is effectively going to do the exact opposite of what's happening in California.
It's absolutely the exact opposite, because it's in Texas, the medical providers are now required to get admitting privileges, which has nothing to do with actual safety. But, you know, I think what you'll find in Texas will be the mirror image. What you're already finding in Texas is the mirror image of what's happening in California, which is in California, you know, when things are going well, you know, maybe a public health researcher can pick up on it, but no news is good news.
Right.
There aren't complications. There isn't violence against providers. Women are just getting the care that they need and moving on. In Texas, unfortunately, what you're already hearing from medical providers down there is, unfortunately, women resorting to unsafe means or trying to obtain medication to end their pregnancies in illegal ways. So, you know, just banning abortion is not going to make it go away, or making it very inaccessible will not end the need for abortion. So unfortunately, I think that Texas and California, the two biggest states, are really two sides of the same coin, and they're kind of funhouse mirrors of each other.
Are there any other states that, I mean, certainly there are states that are attempting and have implemented sort of a Texas-style regime to inhibit access to abortion services? Are there any states that are moving towards the California model?
From what I understand, there has been some interest from local activists, you know, talking to, how did you guys do this? Another part that you know, would be great to know is that one reason that the California bill was able to pass through the legislature is that they had buy-in from great grassroots reproductive justice activists who were young, who were came from a range of communities, including the Latino community and the African American community. They really built a coalition along with the medical community, various nurses associations, to get this passed. So I think people know that the science is there. The political will is challenging. If you know, they have heard from other states, but really the first question is, how did you guys do this? Because it's one thing to beat back a restriction, and it's quite another to pass a law that affirmatively expands access to what is still a very controversial procedure.
Well, is it that controversy that would inhibit advocacy groups from signing on? Because that seems to me like a fairly obvious thing to do.
I think more about advice about how do you get legislators to buy in.
Right.
That's the question. You know, not every state is California. Not every legislature has a majority whip who is sympathetic to this. So I think what they're actually trying, that the other states that are interested in this, first they could see how well it goes in California. And so far, again, no news is good news. And then they can take notes about how do you get a legislature to make that jump. Not because that jump is controversial to them, but because
right.
people are fearful of voting for quote-unquote more abortions.
And lastly, is there any sense that there was a political price to pay from those legislators? Because I imagine that's going to be one of the premier arguments, right? If you come back to your state and you say, look what California did. Yeah, it's California, but this guy's in a partisan index, three, and it was fine.
Right. I mean, I think that there is in California, it's notable that even in California, they weren't able to get it passed the first time that they introduced it in 2012. And that was, there were lots of excuses around that, but I think it ultimately came down to the fact that it was an election year.
Right.
In 2013, they were further away from the election, and it was at that point that the study had been published, and there seemed to be fewer risks. But I'm not aware of any legislator who got in trouble in their district for voting for this.
Erin Carmone from MSNBC.com, thanks so much for your time today. Fascinating story, both of them.
Thank you so much, Sam.
All right, folks. I want to get to this Dianne Feinstein sound. Tomorrow we're planning to talk to Mark Mazzetti on the original reporting that revealed, and here's the sort of the backstory here. The Senate Intelligence Committee did a report on the torture regime set up by the CIA during the Bush years. This report was not released. It was found during the course of developing this report that, unbeknownst and untold to the Senate Intelligence Committee, the CIA had done their own report on the torture regime, and it had said a lot of different things about that torture regime than the CIA had said to the Senate Intelligence Committee. The Senate Intelligence Committee became aware of that report by digging through CIA computers that the CIA had allowed them access to. Apparently, the CIA was monitoring, spying, if you will, on those staffers who were digging through this material. That is not supposed to happen. And apparently Dianne Feinstein finally saw the light. What also, and we will listen to these three clips here, what also appears to have happened is that the CIA attempted to intimidate those staffers. Let's listen to clip number one. This is Dianne Feinstein. And let me start by saying this. If you are part of the surveillance state and Dianne Feinstein has a problem with you, then we should all have a big problem with you. She is not the first person to get agitated by this stuff. She very well may be, the last person, short of John Brennan, who now has the CIA. What's that? Okay, so this is clip number one. Dianne Feinstein on the floor of the Senate. This is a speech that Patrick Leahy said may be the most important speech given about oversight of the CIA since the Church Committee hearings.
On January 17th, I wrote a letter to Director Brennan objecting to any further CIA investigation due to the separation of powers, constitutional issues that the search raised. I followed this with a second letter on January 23rd to the director, asking 12 specific questions about the CIA's actions, questions that the CIA has refused to answer. Some of the questions in my letter related to the full scope of the CIA's search of our computer network. Other questions related to who had authorized and conducted the search and what legal basis the CIA claimed gave it authority to conduct the search. Again, the CIA has not provided answers to any of my questions. My letter also laid out my concern about the legal and constitutional implications of the CIA's actions. Based on what Director Brennan has informed us, I have grave concerns that the CIA's search may well have violated the separation of powers principles embodied in the United States Constitution, including the speech and debate clause. It may have undermined the constitutional framework essential to effective congressional oversight of intelligence activities or any other government function.
So basically what she's saying is I sent you guys two letters saying, wait, you've been spying on us? How much have you been spying on us? And where do you get off spying on us? And she is here suggesting that there are at least a couple of potential violations of the Constitution. And then she goes on to in this next segment of the speech, to say there may be actually some other violations of the Constitution and statutory ones.
Besides the constitutional implication, the CIA's search may also have violated the Fourth Amendment, the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, as well as Executive Order 12333, which prohibits the CIA from conducting domestic searches or surveillance. Days after the meeting with Director Brennan, the CIA Inspector General David Buckley learned of the CIA search and began an investigation into CIA's activities. I have been informed that Mr. Buckley has referred the matter to the Department of Justice, given the possibility of a criminal violation by CIA personnel.
So Feinstein is now saying that in addition to the first mentions of the broad constitutional framework that may have been undermined here, there are specific amendments of the Constitution that may have been violated. There are statutory violations, i.e. CIA is not supposed to be spying on anybody in America, never mind lawmakers. And it would be sort of somewhat poetic that they were caught up in those the statutes regarding computer fraud. And then she goes on to say that the CIA's own inspector general has now referred this to a Department of Justice investigation, which she is making clear, I think, on the Senate floor so that the DOJ does something about this. Because we know this is the turn the page administration. And we're not even talking about the original findings that are in the torture report, which in themselves may compel, and I would say it seems obvious now, would compel criminal investigations. Why else would the CIA not want this report released? Here she talks about the other aspect of this, where the CIA is now actively trying to intimidate the Senate and their staffers Play clip three.
I was also told that after the Inspector General reviewed the CIA's activities to the Department of Justice, referred the CIA's activities to the Department of Justice, the Acting Counsel General of the CIA filed a crimes report with the Department of Justice concerning the committee staff's actions. I have not been provided the specifics of these allegations or been told whether the department has initiated a criminal investigation based on the allegations of the CIA's acting general counsel. As I mentioned before, our staff involved in this matter had the appropriate clearances, handled this sensitive material according to established procedures and practice to protect classified information, and were provided access to the Panetta review by the CIA itself. As a result, there is no legitimate reason to allege to the Justice Department that Senate staff may have committed a crime. I view the Acting Consul General's referral as a potential effort to intimidate this staff, and I am not taking it lightly.
So there you have her saying that this whole attempt to bring criminal charges or to imply that criminal charges could be brought against her staffers for doing their job was basically a means in which to simply scare them off of the trail. Who is the acting general counsel of the CIA? It's a guy named Robert Ettinger. And Marcy Wheeler points out, gives a hat tip to the DOSX blog for identifying Ettinger as the lawyer who, or one of two lawyers, who tacitly sanctioned the destruction of the torture tapes. You'll recall back in the day, there were torture tapes. This is what the harrowing moments of senators and lawmakers going into a room and coming out and saying, "Holy crap. What have we done?" Well, former CIA clandestine branch chief Jose Rodriguez ordered the destruction of the tapes at that time. And he did so upon legal advice from agency lawyers Stephen Hermes and Robert Ettinger. They didn't endorse the destruction of the tapes. They didn't say, go do it. But they said there was no legal impediment to disposing of them. This is also a guy who apparently was part of the Counterterrorism Center's legal team, perhaps, I think, the chief lawyer, and approved all sorts of tortury things to do to people that they were holding. So if there's anybody who's obviously interested in mitigating the release or what is in that torture report, it would be this guy. So this is just the beginning of what we're seeing now. And Dianne Feinstein, I mean, it's quite possible she was just engaging in theater, but that was fairly dramatic theater for someone under, you know, little obligation to do so, as far as I could tell. But I guess the lesson here is, well, we spy on regular people. That's one thing. But when you try and intimidate my staffers, you've gone too far, sir. All right. But we, like I say, we'll follow up on this story significantly tomorrow. But it's a big deal. And I wanted to get it out there today. Folks, this show relies on the support, on the kindness of strangers. I mean, not total strangers, but people who listen to the show regularly, or even semi-regularly. Or frankly, if you don't want to listen at all, that's fine too, if you really want to become a member.
Send a check.
But You can become a member today at majority.fm. Pennies a day, and it's your support that makes this show possible. Also, if you buy your crap from Amazon, buy it through our link at majoritireportkickback.com. Click on the link, bookmark it, buy all your Amazon crap through there. We get a kickback. JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Coupon code majority, get 10% off. Get the app for the show today at majorityapp.com. Listen to the show in your car. Listen to it live. Listen to it on demand. The app allows you to stream the podcast or to download it to your phone. Super easy. So if you're getting in the subway, if you're driving through an extended tunnel, if you're on an airplane, maybe you come to work in a helicopter. Give us a review on iTunes. Give us a review for the app. Donate your Twitter or Facebook account for a retweet or a repost once a day, once a week, once a month. You choose at donateyouraccount.com/majorityfm. I guess I got nothing else to ask of you. Unless you want to be a part of the program, you can call in at 646-257-3920. That's a one-touch button on your app. Or you can IM us at Majority FM. See you soon.